Thanks for checking out this past Sunday's teaching. Every Tuesday, we'll release audio from the previous Sunday's message. If you want to hear the Vertical staff talk more about what these teachings mean for everyday life, a roundtable discussion releases every Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
There are certain times when a series goes past the original intent and design inside of a church community. I believe right now we're in the end of one of those series called Consider the Raven. Although we had very clear plans about what we wanted to get across, specifically around the topic of fear, we had no idea the impact that it would make inside of our community. I believe this is a very clear signal that God is up to something much larger even than we understood at the time of planning this series, and that's proven to be true over the past 4 weeks. I can tell you that this series has changed me in a way that I didn't expect. I've already shared this privately with Austin, but I want to say it publicly now that his teaching last week affected me in a way that I wasn't prepared for. I sat in those gray chairs on a Sunday morning and I realized that this teaching was exactly for me. In ways that I hear many of you talk about, the teaching's taking place every weekend. I had that experience. And I'm so thankful being able to watch him wrestle up close with what God was guiding him to say, working through that and then delivering it the way that he did. It made a huge impact in my life. And it's actually changed the way that I'm behaving inside of my family. Thinking about the fact that I have been friends with fear for a very long time and then rolling through the fact that that fear doesn't only cost me, but it could cost the people around me. The moments where he was describing Saul and the way that his fear actually impacted his sons and having to watch them die because he was on a mountain that maybe he never should have been on in the first place. It rattled me. I'll be honest. It made me think all afternoon, where are the places in my life where my fear is costing my family? I'm thankful to him for that teaching, and I'm also thankful to Vertical Church because it is a place where we can push into the uncomfortable places in our lives so that we can learn and we can become more like Jesus. I've made the decision to extend this series just one more week, and it's not because we did a bad job or Austin did a bad job wrapping up the life of Saul and talking about his demise. It's not that reason at all. It's because I feel the pressing of God on me that there's more to be said about this topic, specifically the place that we're going to go today to help to decode some things around our lives and around our story. I'm going to answer that pressing of God, and we're going to talk about Consider the Raven one more week this week, and specifically we're going to try to decode the strategies of our adversary, of the enemy. Before we get to that place, I'd like to just set the stage for where we're going. It's going to be a foundational thing before we get to Ephesians 6 in the Bible. We're going to talk about a little bit later in this teaching. It feels like in our current climate, we've been given only one of two choices. Imagine it like this. We've come to a fork in the road, and there are two ways to go, and each of them have been defined. The current rhetoric inside our culture is dramatic and negative, not only from politicians and from media, but honestly from many of the Christian leaders that I see across our nation. We're covered in the negative. We're starting to have dramatic conversations about the end of the world. And in some ways, that's almost comically sad. The world has been experiencing tribulation for a very long time, but now that it's affecting America, we're predicting the end of the world. I want to caution you from going to that place too quickly. The narrative these days is dramatic and negative, and it's painted two pictures for us, one road and another, and it's the only choices we've been given. I believe it can be described in two phrases. We're going to talk about those very quickly today before we get to our next segment. The first is a phrase that you'll recognize. I actually have a staff member to thank for this, as he mentioned it just a few short hours ago. Ignorance is bliss. This road is defined by the phrase, ignorance is bliss. And I want you to be very careful because this phrase actually sounds incredibly appealing in the beginning. Bliss sounds good, doesn't it? But when this works out in our stories, it actually ends up being best described as a haunted peace. We're feeling peace in our life, but there's something in the back of our mind that tells us we're not addressing the real issues. Ignorance is bliss allows us to live a peaceful life because it gets us so close in relationship with our coping mechanisms. This is a strategy for life that we all use because it's so fast and it's so effective. And it allows us to ignore some very direct problems in our stories. Here's what I'd like to describe it to you in two different ways before we get there. I want to tell you that I've fallen into this trap in my life, even in the past few weeks, ignorance being bliss. Now, some of us need to turn off the news for very specific reasons because it makes our anxiety kick up. But some of us are turning off the news because we'd rather just ignore the things that are going on than actually face them. Here's what ignorance is bliss looks like in our stories. A good drink, a good book, a good time out with friends, a good post on social that says the things that we're already thinking anyway. These things are so fast and so effective. The way they work out in relationships, though, are just a little bit different. I want to see if maybe you could put yourself in these situations. I believe that two things are incredibly under attack inside our culture today: marriage and the now generation. Here's how it works out in marriage. A marriage may look great, blissful from the street, but behind the front door, there's complete chaos. Here's how it looks as you drive by, though. There's a huge home with a 3-bay garage, and both bays are filled with cars that are $50,000+. They're surrounded. This marriage is surrounded by everything it could ever dream of. But if you were to pull the husband or the wife aside and ask for a moment of honesty, you would hear some version of this sentence: I have everything I could ever want and nothing that I actually need. That's what ignorance is bliss sounds like inside of a marriage. Here's one that I've run into a lot in my years inside of our community with students, the now generation. They are buckling under the pressure given to them by educators and the people that are raising them. The level of expectation that students have to live with these days has been unmatched in history, and it's breaking them. How do we know this? Because we have so many young addicts in our culture today. Because of the pressure, because of the things that they're having to fight, they're looking for anything they can find to get relief. But from the outside, everything looks fine because the grades are okay and the future sports star is on track. The checkbook is empty and hotel rooms every weekend. Everything looks great. But if you were to pull these students aside and you were to ask them for a moment of honesty, they would say some version of this sentence: if my parents knew really what was going on, they would help me get help. Our leaders inside of Amplify can confirm this is exactly what happens with our students inside of our student ministry. Ignorance may appear to be blissful from the outside, but on the inside, it will eat us alive. In many ways, this is very normal for us to go to these places, to go down this road of ignorance being bliss, because it's so easy in the very beginning. It's an effective short-term solution. But I believe there's another road that is a possibility for us. It's just not highlighted enough today. We're going to do a little bit of that together. This other road can be defined by this phrase: information is power. One road, ignorance is bliss. The other road, information is power. I want to propose to you today that the things that we don't know actually can hurt us. The situations that we get into where we don't have the information we need to be prepared can render us defenseless and eventually cost us our life. Think about it. In all of the famous stories, and even the not so famous stories, there's usually a hero who enters into a situation that he isn't prepared for, and without the information of the guide, the hero's life is in jeopardy. He usually experiences some trauma and has to double back and fight the same fight again, but with new information. Information is actually power. Without this information, we're at an extreme disadvantage. We live in a time where we know so many things. There's a glut of information out there for us to pursue, but I'm going to propose to you today that the most important things have been selectively camouflaged by our enemy, by the adversary. We're surrounded by information, but the most critical information we need for the most critical battles in our life, which include fear, have been selectively camouflaged. Today, we're going to expose that camouflage. We're going to move into this area, and I'm going to give you the information that you need to live the life that God has designed you to live. These are big promises, but I'm going to make good on them. I'd like to start this portion of the teaching this morning by asking you an honest question. I love doing this because it was taught to me by several mentors in my life as a great way to stop, reflect, learn, and take action. It's amazing the power of a great question. I want to hand one to you today. It sounds like this: when you look back over your story, do you remember the losses and the victories? When you look back over your life and over your story, do you remember the losses and the victories? This is such an exposing question because of this fact. Most of us look back, and if we do remember the victories, we chalk them up to fate or good luck. What we mostly remember are the failures and the labels that those failures hand us. The things that we succeed in our past, we say, well, we just happened into it. It was a lucky thing. The ways that we fail, though, we assign those things to our character, and we accept the labels that those failures give us. We're building some strategies right now to deal with some strategies. Stay with me. A lot of logic thought today. Just in case you don't know if you've been trapped in this in your life, I just want to give you a few labels that I have found to be most common in our community. There are many more, but I want to call these out because I believe there's a solid chance that many of you will understand these as I start to talk about them. Addict. Adulterer. Remember, these are the labels that failure hands us. For those who've dealt with the aftermath of abortion, and I have extreme sensitivity to that, how about this label? Murderer. Crook. No good. Failure. Weak. Stupid. Slow. Poor. These are some strong labels, and there are many more that the people inside of our community are struggling with, laboring under. We believe that the way that life has gone with all its twists and turns has handed us these labels. But I believe that now is the time for us as a community to stop carrying these labels in the most dangerous way. They're usually deeply internal. We don't tell people these are our labels, but we use them as the driving motivation for our life. I want to tell you today that it's not my intention to give a beautifully polished and inspirational speech. There are times for that. This is not the time. There are too many people in our community who are so wounded that they believe that their life is destined to go in a particular way. They're bleeding out and they think that the end is on its way because of their past. I want to give you some information today that you need to reestablish a position of power in your life and take back ground that's been taken from you. There's almost nothing more heartbreaking for me as a leader in this community than to see people who have given up because they believe that ground lost will always be lost. With Jesus Christ, this is never true. We can always retake the ground that's been taken from us. In order to do that, though, we're going to have to go to the Bible and build on that foundation. It is a trustworthy foundation. We're going to seek out some verses in the Bible today to try to help get a map for getting out of this problem that we found ourselves in. We can define as the infection of fear. Let's start again with a question. It's one you've probably not thought about very often. Where does fear come from? If we experience fear, then where does it come from? Does it come from God? Does it not come from God? The answer is a little bit complicated. We're going to use the Bible to pace through that. I want to encourage you, we're going to go to two places in the Bible that have a very similar address. 2 Timothy 1:7 and Proverbs 1:7. If this sort of thing confuses you or you're a note taker, I want to encourage you at this point in this teaching to open up YouVersion, to download the Bible app onto your smart device, and as you're listening to this teaching, follow along. All of our notes are there, the verses are there, and often there's more ways that you can dig into the topic, you can link out to those things. Download that to your smart device and follow along. So let's read 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. For God, pay attention to this language here, for God has not given us a spirit of fear. God has not given us a spirit of fear. According to this verse, fear does not come from God. It's very plain the way that it puts it, but it does enter into some complication as we start to work that out. Because there are certain types of fear that are good, certain types of fear that we should have. Let's read about that in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." Notice that word fear. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So wait a minute. We have the same word showing up in two different places. In one place, it's bad. In another place, it's good. How do we reconcile this? The fear that Proverbs is talking about, the fear of God, is a good fear because it's a fear that is based in two things, humility and respect. It puts us in a proper position before God so that we can receive good things from God. Fearing God is a good thing. I want to be very direct with you today. There are certain things about God that should make us afraid. God is the most powerful thing that we could ever imagine. And having a healthy respect for Him and being humble before Him is an essential part of the Christian life. That sort of fear is good. This isn't the sort of fear that's being talked about in 2 Timothy. God did not give us a spirit of fear. Here's a way to understand this word fear in this context. God did not give us a spirit of cowardice. And this is the way that many of us are living. That's the big difference. Living as cowards is not the life that God has designed us for. How do you know if you're suffering from a spirit of fear? That's a good question. Let's answer it together. 2 Timothy 1:7 actually continues and gives us the information we need to discern that. God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but instead of that, he has given us a spirit of power, love, and self-discipline. Let me read that list again. God has given us a spirit of power, love, and self-discipline. So let's reflect for a moment. Looking back over your life just since March of this year, would your life be defined by power, love, and self-discipline? Or would it be defined by fear? The Spirit of God has given us an ability to live as powerful, loving, disciplined people. And if we are not living that way, my caution to us is we are missing out on a gift that God has already given us because we have become too friendly with fear. This is how powerful that emotion can actually be. It can rob things from us. We've been making that point for weeks now. So it still begs the question, where does fear come from, this bad fear, if it doesn't come from God? Well, if it doesn't come from God, we have very limited options. What I'd like to teach you today is that this kind of fear doesn't come from God. It comes from our adversary. And he's been studying humanity for a very long time. I've been accused at Vertical Church of giving the enemy too much airtime, of paying too much attention to him, and I'd like to answer that directly today. I will give the enemy less attention when I see him becoming less effective with the children of God. Then I will back off. Until then, I will be calling him out, questioning his tactics, and bringing his strategies to light, because the Bible teaches us when we expose the darkness to light, the darkness cannot survive. I'm not giving him too much credit. I'm giving him his due, and he's having a field day with the children of God. And it's time for the courageous people to stand up and start speaking against him. That's exactly what we're doing today. So in order to achieve this, though, we cannot do it without the Bible. We're going to go into Ephesians chapter 6, a chapter that I mentioned just a few weeks ago as I was trying to elevate our perspective on what's actually happening around us. In as clear of a manner as I can today, I'd like to shine a bright light on the power of our fears. I'm going to give you some very effective life strategies before we wrap up this teaching today. Let's start with Ephesians chapter 6. I'm going to read verses 10 through 13 because I want you to have the entire context of how the person writing this was building their argument. He starts this way, a final word. I love that because that lets you know if you've checked out, even if this teaching, if you've checked out, now's the time to tune in. A final word, be strong in the Lord and his mighty power. Put on all of God's armor so that you will be able to stand firm against, notice this phrase, all strategies of the devil. If we're not fighting against flesh and blood, this is the verse I read in week 3, we're not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities of the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. Therefore, in light of all the things that I've just read, therefore, put on every piece of God's armor so that you will be able to resist the enemy in the time of evil. Then, after the battle, you will still be standing firm. I love the language of this verse. I love the empowerment that it gives us. Did you see, though, the parallel between this verse and the life of Saul? Saul standing on that mountain watching his sons die, committing suicide, and by example, forcing his friend to do the same. It didn't have to end this way for Saul. There was another way. He could have ended this battle standing firm if he had been participating in life with God the way that God had designed. I want to give you this phrase because it's going to give us the foundation as a jumping off point for the practical things we're going to talk about today. The battle isn't on the mountain. It's in heaven and it's for our hearts. This is where the true battle is. Too many of us are too distracted by the battles on the mountain. Just like Saul, we're fighting the wrong battles and it's costing the people around us too much, and eventually it could cost us our life. If we participate in the strategies of the enemy, this will be our end. It didn't have to be this way for Saul, and it doesn't have to be this way for us. The battle isn't on the mountain. It's in heaven, and it's for our hearts. I hope that this will give us a little bit of perspective. And let me mention this while I'm at it. This is why I've been speaking so firmly against people who are so enraptured by what's going to happen in the White House in November of this year. The battle isn't on the mountain. I believe in the power of God so much so that I believe that God can affect the hearts of presidents and kings. Maybe we should be focusing more on that than who's actually going to be sitting in that chair. Maybe we should be praying as a believing people that whoever holds that position, that their hearts will be captured by God. So much so that they become unrecognizable to the people around them. Do you believe that God has that power? The battle isn't on the mountain. It's in heaven, and it's for our hearts. What's going on is always about more than just what's going on. Jesus even taught us to pray this way. In his prayer, people ask him, Jesus, would you teach us how to pray? Jesus says, absolutely. We falsely assign it as the Lord's Prayer. It's really our prayer. It's how he's taught us to pray. And he said, God, your rule come in earth as it is in heaven. The rule of God is expansive, and it should overtake the way that we view our own lives. The battle is for your heart, and I'm proposing to you today that you must protect it. The imagery in verse 16 of this chapter is what I'd like to close with today. It's an image that, if we will allow it, will change our perspective on what's actually happening in the circumstances of our lives. Let me read it for us. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 16. In addition to all these, hold up the shield of faith to stop the fiery arrows of the devil. What imagery in this verse. We have an adversary. Jesus even teaches he is one who is against us, who causes death in our story. This verse in Ephesians chapter 6 tells us he accomplishes this with fiery arrows. As you think back over your life, do you see the presence of those fiery arrows in your story? They came from the enemy. We have an adversary, and that adversary is an archer. He prefers to wound from a distance, and the instrument that he uses is intended to stick and to stay. And if we allow it to stay, then it will eventually kill us. So, what do we do about this? What's our strategy against our enemy? I want to break it down into just a few separate things for you today. I want to encourage you in this big step to call you to create a four-person team in your life. Notice how deeply practical this is, maybe the most practical teaching I've ever given at Vertical Church. I'm calling you to develop a four-person team in your life over the next few minutes, making the turn now. I'm going to give you a description of these four people. After I give you the job description, it's going to be your job to go out and to hire them into your story to play these critical roles, a four-person team. The first person you need is a talker. You need someone that's willing to sit with you and listen to your story, the things that you've been hiding, perhaps even for your whole life, and to be able to say smart things back to you about those woundings, the ways that you have been injured by the adversary. You need someone who's willing to be in conversation with you long enough to talk you off the ledge and to settle your panic. Why? Because they know if all you do is talk and you don't address the wound, you will bleed out while making conversation. Secondly, a talker understands that the more that you panic, the faster the poison from the enemy will make its way to your heart and will eventually take you out. You need a talker, and I want to encourage you in this. If you don't have anybody around you quickly that can be a talker, make the decision to pay for a talker. There are people in our community that are excellent talkers, and they will charge you to sit with them, but it is worth that charge. The first person you need to find in your story, in your four-person team, is the talker. Positions 2 and 3, you need two strong ones. You need two strong people in your story that can hold you down for the work that is on its way. Two strong ones. The image that I want you to have here is the parent that takes their child to the doctor to get shots. That moment where the child realizes that the shot is on its way and the parent lays their body over the body of their child, hurting perhaps more than their child is, even in their panic, but they refuse to get up because they know that the shot is more valuable to them than dodging the pain. You need a person, male or female, you need a person on your right and on your left that is willing to hold you down while you have the talker settling down your panic, because the goal is for these fiery arrows of the enemy to come out, If they don't come out, they will take us out. The talker and two strong ones. It's a pretty tough team so far, but there's one final slot that you need to pursue, and it's the surgeon. Talker, two strong ones, and the surgeon. The surgeon, unlike the other three, has to have some pretty strong qualifications. It's going to be their job to finally remove the arrow that has wounded you, perhaps down to your soul. It's a tricky business. And the qualifications they must have is that they must be willing to show you the scars that they have from their own wounds of the fiery arrows. I want to encourage you at this point that you do not need to pursue a surgeon who stands behind a pulpit in a suit and has a squeaky clean life. They are not qualified. We need more Christian leaders in our community that are willing to expose their scars and show where the enemy has wounded them and the tough parts of that arrow being removed. And this way, they will prove themselves qualified. Why is this so important? Because the way they remove the arrow could kill you. If they don't do it correctly, they will cause more damage than when the arrow went in the first place. This is a very practical teaching calling you to pursue four people in your story: the talker, two strong ones, and the surgeon. I'm charging you to pursue this strategy in your life today. Do not delay. This is actually what defines a community. Community isn't just a slogan here at Vertical Church. This is what we mean when we say the words community. Being a community defined by being together. So you find yourself in one of two places today, closing this teaching. You're either wounded, and I'm calling you to develop the courage to find the help that you need, or Jesus has healed you. If you're in that place, you need to be willing to be one of the four for someone else. And this way, we can become a community that changes our community. Let's pray together. God, at times it feels like we've been put in a battle that's stacked against us. Our adversary wounding us early and from a distance. So God, I'm asking that you would allow Vertical Church to hold a place in this community, maybe even different from the rest. We're willing to pursue the wounding, to remove the arrow. God, for those who are hearing this teaching that are desperate to find one of those four people, I ask that you supernaturally provide them quickly. For those of us that know your healing, that know the freedom of those arrows being removed, could you call us to action to be that for other people? We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.